green nylon briefcase.
"Hey, Marcy,"
he said in a booming voice. "Morning, Dem," said the female officer at the front desk. He glanced sideways.
"At her?"
The female officer nodded.
"Yep, Albright, Lenora. Arraignment at 3 o'clock. John's coming in from Soldotna."
The man headed her way, came to a stop outside the jail cell. With a sigh, he pulled a folder out of his dirty nylon briefcase and started reading.
"Pretty detailed confession. Don't you watch television?"
"Who are you?"
"Demby Cow, your court-appointed attorney. We're going to zip in, enter a plea of not guilty, and zip out. The pinks are running, okay? All you have to do is stand up when the court tells you to and say not guilty."
He closed the file.
"Do you have someone who can pay bail?"
"Don't you want to hear my side of it?"
"I've got your confession. We'll talk later. Plenty, I promise. Brush your hair."
He was gone before Lenny could even really process that he'd been here. The courtroom looked more like a small-town doctor's office than a hallowed hall of justice. There was no shining wood, no pew-like seats, no big desk up front, just linoleum floors, a bunch of chairs set out in rows, and desks for the prosecutor and the defense. In the front of the room, beneath a framed picture of Ronald Reagan, a long formica desk awaited the judge. Beside it, a plastic chair awaited witnesses. Lenny slid into her chair alongside her attorney, who was sitting close to the desk, studying tide charts. The prosecutor was seated at the desk across the aisle, a skinny man with a bushy beard, wearing a fishing vest and black pants. The judge walked into the courtroom, followed by the stenographer and the bailiff. The judge wore a long black robe and extra tough fishing boots. He took his place behind the desk and glanced at the clock.
"Let's be quick, gentlemen."
Lenny's lawyer stood.
"May it please the court."
The courtroom door banged open behind them.
"Where is she?"
Lenny could live to be 110 and still know that voice. Her heart did a little flip of joy.
"Large Marge!"
Large Marge barreled forward, bracelets rattling. Her dark, aging face was speckled with tiny black moles, and her hair was a tangle of fuzzy dreadlocks held back from her face by a folded bandana headband. Her denim shirt was too small, stretched taut across her large breasts, and her pants were stained blue from berry picking and tucked into rubber boots. She yanked Lenny right out of the chair and hugged her. The woman smelled of homemade shampoo and wood smoke, of Alaska in the summer.
"Damn it to hell," the judge said, banging his gavel. "What's going on here? We are arraigning this young woman on serious criminal charges."
Large Marge extricated herself from the hug and pushed Lenny back down into the chair.
"God damn it, John, this proceeding is what's criminal."
Marge strode up to the judge's bench, her boots squeaking at every step.
"This girl is innocent of everything, and whack job Ward coerced a confession out of her. And for what? Rendering criminal assistance? Accessory after the fact? Good God. She didn't kill her piece of shit old man. She just ran when her terrified mother told her to. She was 18 years old with an abusive dad. Who wouldn't run?"
The judge slammed his mallet on the desk.
"Marge, you got a mouth on you like a king salmon. Now shut up. This is my courtroom, and this is just a damned arraignment, not a trial. You can present your evidence when it's time."
Large Marge turned to face the prosecutor.
"Drop the damn charges, Adrian. Unless you want to spend the last days of the season in court, everyone in Connick, and probably on the pipeline, knew Ernst Albright was abusive. I will bring an endless stream of folks to testify on this girl's behalf, starting with Tom Walker." "Tom Walker?" the judge said.
Large Marge faced the judge again, crossed her arms in a way that communicated a settling in, a willingness to stand here all day arguing her point.
"That's right."
The judge glanced over at the skinny prosecutor.
"Adrian?"
The prosecutor looked down at the papers spread out in front of him. He tapped a pen on the desk.
"I don't know, Your Honor."
The courtroom door opened. The woman from the front desk at the police station walked through.
She was nervously smoothing her pant leg.
Your Honor, she said.
What is it, Marcy?
The judge boomed. We're busy here.
The governor is on the line. He wants to talk to you. Right now. 1 minute, Lenny was standing beside her lawyer at the desk in the courtroom, and the next thing she knew, she was leaving the police station. Outside, she saw Large Marge standing beside a pickup truck.
What happened? Lenny asked.
Large Marge took Lenny's suitcase and tossed it into the rusted bed of the pickup.
Alaska isn't so different as every place else. It helps to have friends in high places. Tommy called the governor, who got the charges dropped.
She touched Lenny's shoulder.
It's over, kiddo.
Only part of it, Lenny said. There's more.
Yeah. Tom wants you to come to the homestead. He'll take you to see Matthew.
Lenny couldn't let herself think about that yet. She walked around to the passenger side of the pickup and climbed up into the blanket-covered bench seat. Large Marge stepped up into the driver's seat, settling her bulk with a shimmying motion. When she started the engine, the radio came on. Another little piece of my heart now, baby, came growling through the speaker. Lenny closed her eyes.
You look fragile, kiddo,
Large Marge said. Hard not to be. She thought about asking Large Marge about Matthew, but honestly, Lenny felt as if the smallest thing could break her, so she stared out the window instead. As they drove down to the dock, Lenny couldn't help but stare in awe at the magical drizzle of light. The world seemed illuminated from within, fantastical colors bold and gilded, knife peaks of snow and rock, vibrantly green grass, blue sea. The docks were full of fishing boats and noise. Seabirds cawing, engines growling, puffing black smoke into the air, otters gliding in the water between boats, chattering. They boarded Large Marge's red fishing boat, the Fair Chase, and sped across a calm blue Kachemak Bay toward the soaring white mountains. Lenny had to shield her eyes from the glare of sunlight on the water, but there was no way to shield her heart. Memories came at her from all sides. She remembered seeing these mountains for the first time. Had she known then how Alaska would take hold of her, shape her? She didn't know, couldn't remember. It all felt like a lifetime ago. They rounded the tip of Sadie Cove and ducked in between two green, humped islands, their shorelines littered with silvery driftwood and kelp and pebbles. The boat slowed and motored around the rock breakwater. Lenny got her first glimpse of Conneaut Harbor and the town set on stilts above it. They tied down the boat and walked up the gangplank toward the chain-link fence that created the entrance to the harbor from town. She didn't think Large Marge had said anything, but Lenny couldn't really be sure. All she could hear was her own body, coming alive again in this place that would always define her, her heart beating, her lungs drawing breath, her footsteps on the gravel of Main Street. Conneaut had grown in the past years. The clabbered-fronted storefronts were painted bright colors, like pictures she'd seen of fjord-side towns in Scandinavia. The boardwalk that connected everything looked brand new. Street lamps stood like sentinels. Planters full of geraniums and petunias hung from their iron arms. Off to her left was the general store, expanded to twice its original size, with a new red door. The street boasted one shop after another. The snackle shop, the diner, the yarn shop, souvenir places, ice cream stands, outfitters, guides, kayak rentals, and the new Malamute Saloon and the Geneva Inn, which boasted a giant white rack of antlers above the door. She remembered their first day here, with Mama in her new hiking boots and a frothy peasant blouse, saying, I'm a little suspicious of people who use dead animals in their decorating. Lenny couldn't help smiling. Good Lord, they'd been unprepared. Tourists mingled with locals, one still easily distinguishable from the other by clothing. Vehicles lined the street in front of the Malamute Saloon, a few ATVs, some dirt bikes, two pickup trucks, and a lime green Pinto with a duct-taped fender. Lenny climbed into Large Marge's old International Harvester. They drove past the general store, a newly painted bridge,
Fishermen, with lines in the water on either side, swept them over the crystal clear river and deposited them on the gravel road that soon turned to dirt. For the first half mile, there were new signs of civilization. A travel trailer was on blocks in the tall grass. Beside it, a tractor was rusted through. A couple of new driveways, a mobile home. An old school bus parked near the ditch had no tires. Lenny noticed that Large Marge had a new sign at her place. It read, "Kayak and canoe rentals here."
"I love exclamation marks," Large Marge said.
Lenny was going to say something, but then she saw the start of Walker Land, where the arch welcomed guests to the Adventure Lodge and promised fishing, kayaking, bear viewing, and sightseeing flights. Large Marge eased up on the accelerator as they neared the driveway. She glanced at Lenny.
"You sure you're ready to do this? We could wait."
Lenny heard the gentleness in Large Marge's voice and knew that the woman was offering to give Lenny time before she saw Matthew again. "I'm ready." They crossed beneath the Walker Arch and rumbled along, the road evened out by gravel. To her left, 8 new log cabins had been built among the trees, each one positioned to have a sweeping view of the bay. A twisting, hand-railed trail led down to the beach. Not much farther, and they came to the Walker House, now Walker Lodge, still a crown jewel. 2 stories of skinned logs with a huge porch and windows that overlooked the bay and the mountains. There was no junk showing in the yard anymore, no rusting trucks or coils of wire or stacked pallets. Instead, there were wooden partitions here and there, freestanding walls to hide whatever was behind. Adirondack chairs populated the deck. The animal pens had been moved to the distant tree line. Down at the dock, a floatplane was tied up alongside 3 aluminum fishing boats. There were people walking along paths, fishing on the beach. Employees in brown uniforms and guests in color-coordinated rain gear and brand-new fleece vests. MJ bolted out of the lodge, bounded across the deck, maneuvering around the chairs, and came at her, waving something in his hand. Lenny bent down and scooped him up, holding him so tightly he started to wiggle to get free. She didn't realize until right then how afraid she'd been of losing him. Tom Walker headed toward her. Beside him was a pretty, broad-shouldered native woman with hip-length black hair that was going gray in a single wide streak. She wore a faded denim blouse tucked into khaki pants, with a knife sheathed at her belt and a pair of wire cutters sticking out of her breast pocket.
"Hey, Lenny," Mr. Walker said. "I'd like you to meet my wife, Atka."
The woman held out her hand and smiled. "I have heard so much about you and your mother." Lenny's throat felt tight as she shook Atka's rough hand and said, "It's nice to meet you." She looked at Mr. Walker. "Mama would be happy for you." Lenny's voice cracked. They fell silent after that. MJ dropped to his knees in the grass, making his blue triceratops fight his red T-Rex with growling sound effects. "I'd like to see him now," Lenny said. She knew instinctively that Mr. Walker was waiting for her to tell him she was ready. "Alone, I think, if that's okay with you." Mr. Walker turned to his wife.
"Atka, would you and Marge watch the little one for a minute?"
Atka smiled, swept the long hair to her back.
"MJ, do you remember the starfish I told you about? The animal called Uwit by my people, the wrestler of the waves? Would you like to see one?"
MJ shot to his feet.
"Yes, yes!"
Lenny crossed her arms as she watched Large Marge and Atka and MJ walk toward the beach stairs. MJ's high, chattering voice faded gradually away.
"This isn't going to be easy," Mr. Walker said.
"I wish I could have written," she said. "I wanted to tell you and Matthew about MJ, but..." She took a deep breath. "We were afraid they'd arrest us if we came back."
"You could have trusted us to protect you, but we don't need to talk about what happened back then."
"I abandoned him," she said quietly.
"He was in so much pain he didn't know who he was, let alone who you were."
"You think that eases my conscience, that he was in pain?"
You were in pain, too. More than I knew, I guess. You knew you were pregnant?
She nodded. How is he?
It's been a rough road.
Lenny felt acutely uncomfortable in the quiet that fell between them. Guilty.
Come with me,
he said, and took her by the arm, steadying her. They walked past the lodge's cabins, past where the goat pens used to be, and across a sheared hayfield into a stand of black spruce. Mr. Walker stopped. Lenny expected to see a truck, but there wasn't one.
Aren't we going to Homer?
Mr. Walker shook his head. He led her deeper into the trees until they came to a slatted boardwalk lined with gnarly branch railings on either side. Just below it, on a lip of land surrounded by trees, was a log cabin that overlooked the bay. Geneva's old cabin. A wide wooden bridge led from the boardwalk to the front door. No, not a bridge. A ramp. A wheelchair ramp. Mr. Walker walked on ahead, his boots thudding on the ramp-like bridge. He knocked on the door. Lenny heard a muffled voice, and Mr. Walker opened the door and led Lenny inside.
Go on,
he said gently, pushing her inside a small, cozy cabin with a wall of windows overlooking the bay. The first thing Lenny saw was a series of large paintings. One of them, a huge work-in-progress canvas, was propped on an easel. On it, an explosion of color, drops and splatters and streaks that somehow, impossibly, gave Lenny the impression of the Northern Lights, although she couldn't say why. There were strange, misshapen letters in all that color. She could almost make them out, but not quite. Maybe it said, her? The painting made her feel something. Pain first, and then a rising sense of hope.
I'll leave you two,
Mr. Walker said. He left the cabin and closed the door at the same time Lenny saw the man in the wheelchair, sitting with his back to her. He executed a slow turn, his paint-splattered hands agile on the wheelchair, maneuvering himself around. Matthew. He looked up. A network of raised, pale pink scars ran across his face, gave him an odd, stitched-together look. His nose was flattened, had the splayed look of an old boxer's, and his right eye was tugged just the slightest bit downward by a starburst of scar tissue at the top of his cheekbone. But his eyes. In them, she saw him. Her Matthew.
Matthew? It's me, Lenny.
He frowned. She waited for him to say something, anything, but there was nothing, just this aching, drawn-out silence where once there had been an endless stream of words. She felt tears start.
It's Lenny,
she said again, softer. He stared at her, just kept staring, like he was dreaming.
You don't know me, she said, wiping her eyes. I knew you wouldn't. And you won't understand about MJ. I knew that. I knew it. It's just...
She took a step backward. She couldn't do this now. Not yet. She would try again later. Practice her words. She'd explain it to MJ. Prepare him. They had time now, and she wanted to do this right. She turned toward the door. 31.
Wait.
Matthew sat in the wheelchair, clutching a sticky paintbrush, his heart racing. They had told him she was coming, but then he'd forgotten, and remembered, and forgotten again. It was like that for him sometimes. Things got lost in the confused circuitry of his brain. Less often these days, but it happened. Or maybe he hadn't believed. Or he'd thought he'd imagined it, that they'd said the words to make him smile, hoping he'd forget. He still had fog days when nothing made it up from the mist, not words or ideas or sentences, just pain. But she was here. He had dreamed of her return for years, played and replayed the possibilities, imagined and massaged ideas. He had practiced words for it, for her, alone in this room, where stress wouldn't seize control and render him mute, where he could pretend that he was a man worth coming back to.
He tried not to think about his ugly face and his never-quite-right leg. He knew that sometimes he couldn't think well, and words became impossible creatures that ran at his approach. He heard his once strong voice tripping up, sending out idiot words, and he thought, "That can't be me," but it was. He dropped the wet paintbrush and clutched the armrests of the wheelchair, forced himself to stand. It hurt so badly he made a grunt of pain, and it shamed him, that noise, but there was nothing he could do. He gritted his teeth, repositioned his leg. He'd been sitting for too long, consumed by his painting, the one he called Her, about a night he remembered on her beach, and he'd forgotten to move. He shambled forward in a lurching, unsteady gait that probably made her think he could fall at any moment. He'd fallen a lot, gotten up even more.
"Matthew?"
She moved toward him, her face tilted up. Her beauty made him want to cry. He wanted to tell her that when he painted, he felt her, remembered her, that it had started in rehab as occupational therapy, and now it was his passion. Sometimes when he was painting, he could forget all of it, the pain, the memories, the loss, and imagine a future with Lenny, their love like sunshine and warm water. He imagined them having kids, growing old together, all of it. He strained to find all those words. It was like suddenly being in a dark room. You knew there was a door, but you couldn't find it. "Breathe, Matthew." Stress made it worse. He drew in a breath, released it. He limped over to the bedside table, picked up the box full of letters she'd sent him all those years ago while he was in the hospital, and the others, the ones she'd sent when he was a grief-stricken kid in Fairbanks. They were how he'd learned to read again. He handed it to her, unable to ask the question that had haunted him. "Why did you stop writing to me?" She looked down, saw the letters in the box, and looked up at him.
"You kept them? After I left you?"
"Your letters," he said.
He knew the words were elongated. He had to concentrate to create the combinations he wanted.
"Were how I learn to read again."
Lenny stared up at him.
"I prayed you'd come back," he said.
"I wanted to,"
she whispered. He gave her a smile, knowing how it pulled down the skin at his eye, made him look even more freakish. She put her arms around him, and he was amazed at how they still fit together. After all the ways he'd been put back together, restrung and bolted up, they still fit together. She touched his scarred face.
"You are so beautiful."
He tightened his hold on her, tried to steady himself, feeling suddenly, inexplicably, afraid.
"Are you okay? Are you in pain?"
He didn't know how to say what he was feeling, or he was afraid that if he said it, she'd think less of him. He'd been drowning for all of these years without her, and she was the shore he'd been flailing to find. But surely she would look into his ravaged, stitched-together face and run away, and then he would drift back into the deep, dark waters alone. He pulled away, limped back over to his wheelchair, and sat down with an oomph of pain. He shouldn't have held her, felt her body against his. How would he ever forget the feel of her again? He tried to get back onto an ordinary track, but couldn't find his way. He was trembling.
"Where have you been?"
"Seattle."
She moved toward him.
"It's a long story."
At her touch, the world, his world, cracked open or broke apart, something. He wanted to revel in the moment, burrow into it like a pile of furs and let it warm him, but none of it felt real or safe.
"Tell me."
She shook her head.
"I disappoint you."
"You aren't the disappointment, Matthew. I am. I always have been. I was the one who left, and when you needed me most. I would understand if you can't forgive me. I can't forgive me. I did it because, well, there's someone you need to meet. Afterwards, if you still want to, we can talk."
Matthew frowned.
Someone here?
Outside with your dad and Otka. Will you come with me to meet him? Him. Disappointment settled deep, all the way to his bolted-together bones.
I don't need to meet... you're him.
You're mad. I get it. You said we always stand by the people we love, but I didn't. I ran.
Don't talk. Go,
he said in a harsh voice.
Please, just go.
She looked at him, tears in her eyes. She was so beautiful, he couldn't breathe. He wanted to cry, to scream. How would he ever let her go? He had been waiting for this moment, for her, for them, for all the years he could remember, through pain so bad he cried in his sleep, but every day he woke and thought, her, and he tried again. He'd imagined a million versions of their future, but he'd never imagined this, her coming back just to say goodbye. You have a son, Matthew. It happened for him like that sometimes. He heard the wrong words, took in information that wasn't there. His screwed-up brain. Before he could guard against it, use his learned tools, the pain of those words crashed down on him. He wanted to let her know that he'd misunderstood, but all he could do was howl, a deep, rolling growl of pain. Words abandoned him. All he had left was pure emotion. He lurched out of the chair and stumbled backward, away from her, hitting the kitchen counter hard. It was his damaged brain, telling him what he wanted to hear instead of what was actually said. Lenny moved toward him. He could see how hurt she was, how crazed she thought he was, and shame made him want to turn away.
Go! If you're leaving, go!
Matthew, please, stop. I know I've hurt you. She reached out for him. Matthew, I'm sorry.
Go away. Please.
You have a son, she said slowly. A son. We have a son. Do you understand me? He frowned.
A baby?
Yes. I brought him to meet you. At first, he felt pure, exquisite joy. Then the truth hit him hard. A son, a child of his, of theirs. It made him want to cry for what he'd lost.
Look at me,
he said quietly. I'm looking.
I look like someone rebuilt me with a bad sewing machine. Sometimes it hurts so much I can't speak. It took me 2 years to stop grunting and screaming and say my first real word.
And? He thought of all the things he'd once imagined he would teach a son, and it collapsed around him. He was too broken to hold anyone else together.
I can't pick him up. Can't put him... on my shoulders. He won't want this for a dad.
He knew Lenny heard the longing in his voice at that, the universe in a three-letter word. She touched his face, let her fingers trace the scars that put him back together, stared up into his green eyes. You know what I see? A man who should have died but wouldn't give up. I see a man who fought to talk and walk and think. Every one of your scars breaks my heart and puts it back together. Your fear is every parent's fear. I see the man I have loved for my whole life, the father of our son.
Don't know how.
No one knows how. Believe me, can you hold his hand? Can you teach him to fish? Can you make him a sandwich?
I'll embarrass him, he said.
Kids are durable, and so is their love. Trust me, Matthew, you can do this.
Not alone.
Not alone. It's you and me, just like it was always supposed to be. We'll do it together, okay?
promise?
I promise. She held his face in his hands and rose up onto her toes to kiss him. With that one kiss, so like another kiss from long ago, a lifetime ago, two kids believing in a happy ending, he felt his world come back into alignment.
Come meet him,
she whispered against his lips.
He snores just like you do, and he bumps into every piece of furniture, and he loves Robert Service poems.
She took his hand. Together, they walked out of the cabin, him limping slowly, holding her hand tightly, leaning on her, letting her steady him. Wordlessly, they made their way out of the trees and past the house that was now a world-class fishing lodge toward the new beach stairs. As always, the shoreline was full of guests, dressed in their new Alaska rain gear, fishing at the water's edge, birds cawing in the air, waiting for scraps. He held on to Lenny with one hand and clutched the handrail with his other and made his slow, halting way down the stairs. On the beach, off to the right, Large Marge was drinking a beer. Alyeska was out in the bay giving kayak lessons to guests. Dad and Otka were with a child, a blonde boy, who was squatted over a big purple starfish. Matthew came to a stop.
Mommy!
The boy said at Lenny's appearance. He jumped up, smiling so big it lit his whole face.
Did you know that starfish have teeth? I seen 'em.
Lenny looked up at Matthew. Our son, she said, and let go of Matthew's hand. He limped toward the little boy, stopped. Meaning to bend, he crashed down to one knee, grimaced in pain, groaned.
You sound like a bear. I like bears. So does my new grandpop. Do you?
I like bears, Matthew said, unsure.
He looked into his son's face and saw his own past. He suddenly remembered things he'd forgotten, the feel of frog's eggs in your hand, the way a good laugh sometimes shook your whole body, stories being read by a campfire, playing pirates on the shore, building a fort in the trees. All of that he could teach. Of all the things he'd dreamed of over the years, tried like hell to believe in when his pain was at its worst, this was something he'd never dared to even hope for. My son.
I'm Matthew.
Really? I'm Matthew Jr., but everyone calls me MJ.
Matthew felt an emotion unlike anything he'd ever felt before. Matthew Jr. My son, he thought again. He found it difficult to smile, realized he was crying.
I'm your dad.
MJ looked at Lenny.
Mommy?
Lenny came up beside them, laid a hand on Matthew's shoulder, and nodded.
That's him, MJ. Your dad. He's waited a long time to meet you.
MJ grinned, showed off his two missing front teeth. He threw himself at Matthew, hugged him so ferociously they toppled over. When they came back up, MJ was laughing.
You want to see a starfish?
Sure,
Matthew said. Matthew tried to get up, put his hand on the ground. Bits of shell stuck to his palm as he stumbled, his bad ankle giving way. And then Lenny was there, taking his arm, helping him stand up again. MJ raced down to the water, talking all the way. Matthew couldn't make his feet move. All he could do was stand there, breathing shallowly, a little afraid that all of this could break like glass at the merest touch, at a breath. The boy who looked like him stood at the shore, blonde hair glinting in the sun, the hem of his jeans wet with salt water, laughing. In that one image, Matthew saw the whole of his life, past, present, and future. It was one of those moments, an instant of grace in a crazy, sometimes impossibly dangerous world that changed a man's life.
You'd better go, Matthew, Lenny said. Our son is not very good at waiting for what he wants.
He looked down at her and thought, God, I love her. But his voice was gone,
lost in this new world in which everything had changed, in which he was a father. They had come so far from their beginnings as two damaged kids, he and Lenny. Maybe it had all happened the way it needed to. Maybe they'd each crossed their own oceans, hers of damaged love and loss, his of pain, to be here again together, where they belonged.
Good thing I am.
He saw what those words meant to her.
I wanted to stand by you. I wanted...
You know what I love most about you, Lenny Albright?
What?
Everything.
He took her in his arms and kissed her with everything that he had and all he hoped to have. When he finally let go, reluctantly, and drew back, they stared at each other, had a whole conversation in breaths taken and expelled. This was a beginning, he thought, a beginning in the middle, something unexpected and beautiful.
You'd better go, Lenny finally said.
Matthew walked carefully across the pebbled beach toward the boy standing at the waterline.
Hurry up, MJ said,
waving Matthew over to the big purple starfish.
It's right here. Look, look, Daddy.
Daddy. Matthew saw a flat, charcoal-gray stone, small as a new beginning, polished by the sea, and picked it up. The weight of it was perfect, the size exactly what he wanted. He held it out to his son, said,
Here, I'll show you how to skip rocks. It's cool. I taught your mom the same thing a long time ago. He always believed you'd come back,
Mr. Walker said, coming up beside Lenny.
Said he'd know if you were dead, that he'd feel it. His first word was her. It didn't take us long to know he meant you.
How do I make up for leaving him?
Aw, Lenny, it's life. Things don't always go the way you expect.
He shrugged.
Matthew knows that, better than any of us.
How is he really?
He has struggles, pain sometimes. He has trouble putting his thoughts into words when he gets stressed, but he's also the best guide on the river, and the guests love him. He volunteers at the rehab center, and you've seen his paintings. It's almost like God gave him that gift in compensation. His future isn't like everyone else's, maybe, not what you'd imagined when you were both 18.
I have my struggles, too, Lenny said quietly. And we were kids then. We're not now.
Mr. Walker nodded.
There's really only one question. Everything else will follow.
He turned to look at her.
Are you staying?
She did her best to smile. She was pretty sure this was the question he'd come over to ask. As a parent herself, she understood. He didn't want his son hurt again.
I have no idea what this new life of mine will look like, but I'm staying.
He laid a hand on her shoulder. Down on the beach, MJ leaped into the air.
I did it! I made the rocks skip! Mommy, did you see that?
Matthew looked back and gave Lenny a crooked smile. He and his son looked so much alike, both of them smiling at her, standing together against the cornflower blue sky. Peas in a pod, two of a kind, the beginning of a whole new world of love. Although she had thought about it often over the years, mythologized it almost, Lenny realized that she had forgotten the true magic of a summer night when the darkness didn't fall. Now she was sitting at one of the picnic tables down on the Walker Beach. A lingering scent of roasted marshmallows hung in the air, sweetened the briny tang of the sea washing ceaselessly back and forth. MJ stood at the shore, casting his line into the water, reeling it back in. Mr. Walker stood on one side of him, giving him tips, helping him when the line got tangled or when he snagged something. Alyeska was standing on his other side, casting a line of her own. Lenny knew that MJ was going to fall asleep where he stood any minute. As much as she loved sitting here, soaking in this new image of her life, she knew she was avoiding something that mattered. With each minute that passed, she felt the weight of her avoidance, like a hand on her shoulder, a gentle reminder. She slid off the seat, got to her feet. She no longer knew how to judge time by the color of the sky, a brilliant amethyst speckled with stars, so she looked at her watch. 9:25.
Are you okay?
Matthew said. He held on to her hand until she pulled gently away, then he let go. I need to go see my old house. He rose, winced in pain as he put weight on his bad foot. She knew it had been a long day on his feet for him. She touched his scarred cheek. I'll go. I saw a bike up by the lodge. I just want to stand there. I'll be right back.
But
I can do it alone. I know you're in pain. Stay with MJ. When I get back, we'll put him to bed. I'll show you the stuffed animals he can't sleep without and tell you his favorite story. It's about us. She knew that Matthew would argue, so she didn't let him. This was her past, her baggage. She turned away from him and went up the beach stairs and climbed to the grassy land above. There were still several guests sitting on the deck at the lodge, talking loudly, laughing, probably honing the fish stories they would take home with them. She took a bike from the rack by the lodge and climbed on, pedaling slowly over the spongy muskeg, crossing the main road, turning to the right toward the end of the road. There was the wall, or what was left of it. The planks had been hacked apart, pulled away from the stanchions. The ruined slats lay in heaps, furred with moss and darkened by years of harsh weather. Large Marge and Tom, maybe Thelma. She could imagine them gathering here in their grief, holding axes, splintering the wood. She turned into the driveway, which was knee-high with weeds and grass. Shade siphoned away the light. The world was quiet here, in the way of woodlands and abandoned homes. She had to slow down, pedal hard. At last, she turned into the clearing. The cabin sat off to the left, worn by time and the elements, but still standing. Alongside it, empty, sagging animal pens, gates gone, fences broken by predators, probably home to all kinds of rodents. The tall grass, threaded with bright pink fireweed and prickly devil's club, had grown up around the junk they'd left behind. Here and there, she could see mounds of rusting metal and decaying wood. The old truck had collapsed, bowed forward like an old horse. The smokehouse was a pyramid of silvered, moldy boards collapsed in on itself. Inexplicably, the clothesline remained, clothespins attached, bouncing in the breeze. Lenny dismounted, carefully set the bike on its side in the grass. Feeling more than a little numb, she headed toward the cabin. Mosquitoes buzzed in a cloud around her. At the door, she paused, thought, "You can do it," and opened the door. It felt like going back in time, to the first day she'd been in here, with insect carcasses thick on the floor. Everything was as they'd left it, but covered in dust. Voices and words and images from the past drifted through her mind. The good, the bad, the funny, the horrific. She remembered it all in a blinding, electric flash. She closed her hand around the heart necklace at her throat, her talisman, felt the sharp bit of bone press into her palm. She drifted through the place, rattled the psychedelic beads that had given her parents the illusion of privacy. In their bedroom, she saw the dusty heap of belongings that revealed who they'd once been. A tangle of furs on the bed, jackets hanging from hooks, a pair of boots with the toes eaten away. She found her dad's old bicentennial bandana and shoved it in her pocket. Her mother's suede headband hung from a hook on the wall. She took it, wound it like a bracelet around her wrist. Up in her loft, she found her books lying scattered, the pages yellowed and chewed through. Many had become a home to mice, as had her mattress. She could smell their scent in the air, a decaying, dirty smell. The smell of a place forgotten. She climbed back down the loft ladder, dropped onto the dirty, sticky floor, looked around. So many memories. She wondered how long it would take her to work through them all. Even now, standing here, she didn't know exactly how she felt about this place, but she knew, she believed, she could find a way to remember the good in it. She would never forget the bad. But she would let it go. She had to. There had been fun, too, Mama had said, and adventure. Behind her, the door opened. She heard uneven footsteps come up behind her. Matthew stepped in beside her.
Alone is overrated, he said simply. Do you want to fix it up? Live here?
Maybe. Or maybe we'll burn it down and rebuild. Ashes make great soil. She didn't know yet. All she knew was that she was back here at last, after all those years away, back with the crazy, durable fringe dwellers in a state that was like nowhere else, in this majestic place that had shaped her, defined her. Once, a lifetime ago, she had worried about girls, only a few years older than her, who had gone missing. The stories had given her nightmares at 13. Now, she knew there were 100 ways to be lost, and even more ways to be found. Such a thin veil separated the past from the present. They existed simultaneously in the human heart. Anything could transport you, the smell of the sea at low tide, the screech of a gull, the turquoise of a glacier-fed river. A voice in the wind could be both true and imagined, especially here. On this hot summer day, the Kenai Peninsula was vibrant with color. There wasn't a cloud in sight. The mountains were a magical mixture of lavender and green and ice blue, valleys and cliffs and peaks. There was still snow above the tree line. The bay was sapphire, almost waveless. Dozens of fishing boats puttered alongside kayaks and canoes. Today was a day to be on the water for Alaskans. Lenny knew that Bishop's Beach, the straight, sandy stretch below the Russian church in Homer, would be one long line of trucks and empty boat trailers, just as she knew that some clueless tourist would be out on the sand, digging for clams and not paying attention, and get caught by the tide. Some things never changed. Now Lenny stood in her overgrown yard, with Matthew beside her. Together, they walked over to the grassy rise above the beach, met up with Mr. and Mrs. Walker, Alyeska, and MJ, who were already there, waiting. Alyeska gave Lenny a warm, welcoming smile, one that said, "We're in this together now, family." They hadn't had much time to talk in the past 2 days, with the whirlwind of Lenny's return to Alaska, but they both knew there would be time for them, time to stitch their lives together. It would be easy. They loved so many people in common. Lenny took her son's hand. A crowd waited for her on the beach. Lenny felt their eyes on her, noticed how they stopped talking at her approach.
"Look, Mommy, a seal! That fish jumped right out of the water! Whoa! Can we go fishing with Daddy today? Can we? Aunt Allie says the pinks are still running."
Lenny stared out at the friends gathered at the water's edge. Almost everyone from Connick was here today, even several of the hermits who were only seen at the saloon and sometimes at the general store. At her arrival, no one spoke. One by one, they climbed into their boats. She heard the smack of water on hulls, the crunching of shells and pebbles as they pushed off. Matthew guided her over to a Walker Adventure Lodge skiff. He put a bright yellow life vest on MJ and then settled him on the bench seat in the bow, facing the stern. Lenny climbed aboard. They motored out to where the other boats were. The bay was quiet on this sunny, brilliant early evening. The deep V of the fjord looked majestic in this light. The boats drifted out into the cove and floated together, banged bows. Lenny looked around her. Tom and his new wife, Otka Walker, Alyeska and her husband, Darrow, and their twin 3-year-old boys, Large Marge, Natalie Watkins, Tico Rhodes and her husband, Thelma, Moppet, Ted, and all the Harlans, the faces of her childhood and of her future. Lenny felt them all looking at her. She thought suddenly, sharply, how much this would have meant to Mama, these people coming out to say goodbye, Had Mama known how much they cared?
Thank you, Lenny said. The two inadequate words were lost amid the sound of waves slapping on boat hulls. What should she say?
I don't know how.
Just talk about her,
Mr. Walker said in a gentle voice. Lenny nodded, wiped her eyes, tried again, her voice as loud as she could manage to make it.
I don't know if any woman ever came to Alaska less prepared for it. She couldn't cook or bake or make jam. Before Alaska, her idea of a necessary survival skill was putting on false eyelashes and walking in heels. She brought purple hot pants up here, for God's sake.
Lenny took a breath.
But she came to love it here. We both did. The last thing she said to me before she died was, "Go home." I knew what she meant. If she saw you guys here for her, she would give one of her bright smiles and ask you why you were all here instead of drinking and dancing. Tom, she'd hand you a guitar. And Thelma, she'd ask you what the hell you've been up to. And Large Marge, she'd hug you till you couldn't breathe.
Lenny's voice broke. She looked around, remembering.
It would fill her heart to see you all here. To know you'd given up time with all you have to do to remember her. To say goodbye. She said to me once that she felt like she'd been nothing. A reflection of other people. She never quite understood her own worth. I hope she's looking down now and knows, finally, how loved she was.
A murmur of agreement, a few words, and then quiet. Grief this deep was a silent, lonely thing. From now on, the only time Lenny would hear her mother's voice would be in her own mind, thoughts channeled through another woman's consciousness, a continual quest for connection, for meaning. Like all motherless girls, Lenny would become an emotional explorer, trying to uncover the lost part of her, the mother who had carried and nurtured and loved her. Lenny would become both mother and child. Through her, Mama would still grow and age. She would never be gone, not as long as Lenny remembered her. Large Marge threw a bouquet of flowers into the water.
We'll miss you, Cora,
Large Marge said. Mr. Walker threw a bouquet of fireweed into the water. It floated past Lenny, a bright pink splash on the waves. Matthew met Lenny's gaze. He was holding a bouquet of fireweed and lupin that he'd picked this morning with MJ. Lenny reached into a box and pulled out the mason jar full of ashes. For a lovely moment, the world blurred and Mama came to her, smiled her bright smile and gave her a hip bump and said, "Dance, baby girl." When Lenny looked again, the boats were splashes of color against the blue-green world. She opened the jar, poured the contents slowly into the water. "I love you, Mama," Lenny said. Feeling loss settled deep, as much a part of her now as love. They'd been more than best friends. They'd been allies. Mama had called Lenny the great love of her life, and Lenny thought maybe that was always true for parents and their children. She remembered something Mama had said to her once. Love doesn't fade or die, baby girl. She'd been talking about Matthew and sadness, but it was equally true for mothers and their children. This love she felt for her mother and her son and Matthew and the people around her was a durable thing, as vast as this landscape, as immutable as the sea, stronger than time itself. She leaned over and dropped some bright pink fireweed on a gently rolling wave and watched it float toward the shore. She knew that from now on she would feel her mother's touch in the breeze, hear her voice on the sound of the rising tide. Sometimes, berry picking or making bread or even the smell of coffee would make her cry. For the rest of her life, she would look up into the vast Alaskan sky and say, "Hey, Mama," and remember.
"I will always love you,"
she whispered to the wind.
Always.
My Alaska, July 4th, 2009, by Lenora Albright Walker. If you had told me when I was a kid that someday a newspaper would come to me to talk about Alaska on the 50th anniversary of its statehood, I would have laughed. Who would have thought my photographs would mean so much to so many, or that I would take a picture of the Valdez oil spill that would change my life and make it onto the cover of a magazine? Really, my husband is the one you should speak to. He's overcome every challenge this state has to offer and is still standing. He's like one of those trees that grow on a sheer granite cliff. In the wind and snow and icy cold, they should fall, but they don't. Stubbornly, they remain. Thrive. I am just an ordinary Alaskan wife and mother who prides herself primarily on the children she has raised and the life she has managed, somehow, to wrest from this harsh landscape. But like all women's stories, mine has more to it than sometimes appears on the surface. My husband's family is practically Alaskan royalty. His grandparents carved a life out of the remote wilderness with a hatchet and a dream. The quintessential American pioneers, they homesteaded hundreds of acres and started a town and settled in. My children, MJ, Kenai, and Cora, are the fourth generation to grow up on that land. My family was different. We came to Alaska in the 70s. It was a turbulent time, full of protests and marches and bombings and kidnappings. Young women were being abducted from college campuses. The Vietnam War had divided the country. We came to Alaska to run away from that world. Like so many Chechakos before and since, we planned poorly. We didn't have enough food or supplies or money. We had almost no skills. We moved into a cabin in a remote part of the Kenai Peninsula and learned fast that we didn't know enough. Even our car, a VW bus, was a poor choice. Someone said to me once that Alaska didn't create character, it revealed it. The sad truth is that the darkness in Alaska revealed the darkness in my father. He was a Vietnam veteran, a POW. We didn't know then what all that meant. Now we know. In our enlightened world, we know how to help men like my father. We understand the ways in which war can break the strongest mind. Then, there was no help, nor was there much help for a woman who was his victim. Alaska, the darkness and the cold and the isolation, got inside of my father in a terrible way, turned him into one of the many wild animals who populate the state. But we didn't know that in the beginning. How could we? We dreamed, like so many others, and planned our course and duct-taped our Alaska or Bust banner on our bus and headed north, unprepared. This state, this place, is like no other. It is beauty and horror, savior and destroyer. Here, where survival is a choice that must be made over and over, in the wildest place in America, on the edge of civilization, where water in all its forms can kill you, you learn who you are. Not who you dream of being, not who you imagined you are, not who you were raised to be. All of that will be torn away in the months of icy darkness, when frost on the windows blurs your view and the world gets very small and you stumble into the truth of your existence. You learn what you will do to survive. That lesson, that revelation, as my mother once told me about love, is Alaska's great and terrible gift. Those who come for beauty alone or for some imaginary life, or those who seek safety, will fail. In the vast expanse of this unpredictable wilderness, you will either become your best self and flourish, or you will run away screaming from the dark and the cold and the hardship. There is no middle ground, no safe place, not here, in the great alone. For we few, the sturdy, the strong, the dreamers, Alaska is home. Always and forever, the song you hear when the world is still and quiet. You either belong here, wild and untamed yourself, or you don't. I belong.
Acknowledgement. I come from a long line of adventurers. My grandfather left Wales at 14 to become a cowboy in Canada. My father has spent his life in search of the extraordinary, the remote, the unusual. He goes where most people only imagine going. In 1968, my father thought that California was becoming too crowded. He and my mother decided to do something about it. They loaded all of us, three young kids and two of our friends and the family dog, into a VW bus. In the heat of the summer, off we went. We drove around America, through more than a dozen states, looking for a place to belong. We found it in the green and blue beauty of the Pacific Northwest. Years later, my dad went in search of adventure again. He found it in Alaska, on the shores of the magnificent Kenai River. There, my parents met homesteaders Laura and Kathy Peterson, a mother and daughter, who had operated a resort on that incomparable stretch of riverfront for years. In the early 80s, these two pioneering families came together and began a company that would come to be known as the Great Alaska Adventure Lodge. Three generations of my family have worked at the lodge. All of us have fallen in love with life on the last frontier. I'd like to thank the Johns, Lawrence, Sharon, Debbie, Kent, and Julie, and Kathy Peterson Haley for their boundless enthusiasm and vision in creating such a magical place. I'd also like to thank Kathy Peterson Haley and Anita Merkus for their experience and editorial help in recreating the homesteading world of Alaska and Kachemak Bay in the 70s and 80s. Your insight and support for this project meant so much to me. Any remaining mistakes are, of course, mine. Also to my brother Kent, another adventurer, who answered an endless stream of bizarre questions about Alaska for me. You are, as always, a rock star. Thanks to Carl and Kirsten Dixon and the fabulous team at the Tutka Bay Lodge on Kachemak Bay for welcoming me to their lovely corner of the world. I'd also like to thank a few very special people who helped immeasurably on this novel, especially in the hardest of times, when I felt ready to give up. My brilliant editor, Jennifer Enderlin, who waited patiently, gave advice when asked, and then waited patiently some more. I am so grateful for the extra time and your support. Thanks to Jill Marie Landis and Jill Barnett, who encouraged me when I needed it most. To Ann Patty, who taught me to trust myself. To Andrea Cirillo and Megan Chance, who are always there for me. And to Kim Fisk, who believed in this story and the Alaskan setting from the get-go and was never afraid to say so. Thanks to Tucker, Sarah, Kaylee, and Braden, you have expanded the boundaries of love for me and given me a new world in the middle of my life. And finally, to my husband of 30 years, Benjamin, we have been partners in this writing thing from the beginning, and none of it would be possible without your love and support. Falling in love with you was the best thing I ever did.
This is Julia Whalen. We hope you've enjoyed this production of The Great Alone by Kristen Hanna. Post-production by John Marshall Media. Text copyright 2018 by Kristen Hanna. Production copyright 2018 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.